Blog Talk Radio.
Armed with Science, Research and Applications for the Modern Military is a weekly webcast that discusses cutting-edge science and technology and how they apply to military operations. Each week, we will interview scientists, administrators, and operators to educate and inform our listeners about the importance of science and technology to the modern military.
Good afternoon, and welcome to episode number 56 of the Armed with Science podcast. On Wednesday, February 24th, 2010, I am Dr. John Ohab at the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs. I know I say this a lot, but we have a really cool show for you guys today, and another that fits under the extreme science category. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about military science support in Antarctica. Today, we're talking about scientific research in icy Alaska. I'm joined by members of the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or also known as HAARP, which is a joint Air Force and Navy endeavor to enhance knowledge of radio science, surveillance, and space systems. The HAARP team is investigating an atmospheric layer of charged particles known as the ionosphere. These charged particles impact long-range communications and space operations, and HAARP's goal is to understand this impact so they can improve these systems. Joining me today is Mr. James Battis, HAARP Program Manager with the Air Force Research Laboratory, Dr. Todd Pedersen, Senior Research Physicist at the Air Force Research Laboratory, Dr. Craig Selker, HAARP Program Manager with the Naval Research Laboratory, and Dr. Paul Bernhardt, Senior Research Physicist at the Naval Research Laboratory. Gentlemen, it's a real pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Just a note to our listeners, you can tweet in questions as the show progresses. Send those to @armedwscience. I will be monitoring Twitter, and I can get those questions to our guests. I will direct questions to the guests, and you guys are all free to jump in as appropriate. We're going to get into the nuts and bolts of what you guys are doing as the show progresses, but first I was hoping we could get just a brief overview of the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, also known as HAARP, and some of its primary goals.
The High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or as you say, is a program that's known as HAARP, is basically a DOD Joint Air Force Navy program to investigate ionospheric physics and radio science. And the program has two components to it. One is a large facility, large radio transmitter array that we operate in Alaska, and the second part is the science efforts, which we are also run under the program, and actually some of the science programs are independent of the HAARP program. In other words, people come to the site and use the facility for their research and independently of our science efforts.
And I should have mentioned at the start, if you could please just say your name before you start answering. We're going to have this transcribed so everyone knows who's saying what. One of the central aspects of the program you mentioned was the ionosphere and understanding this particular part of the atmosphere. Can you tell us in plain language what is the ionosphere?
I'll take that one. This is Todd Pedersen. The ionosphere is a region of the upper atmosphere about 100 miles plus or minus above the Earth's surface where there's a significant number of charged particles. These are air molecules and atoms that have been hit by photons from the sun, typically ultraviolet rays from the sun, and the electrons get knocked off. They float around a while, and eventually they find each other, meet up again, and become a normal neutral atom or molecule. In the meantime, they're part of the plasma. The electrons and the positive ions remaining can conduct electrical currents. They respond to electric fields and also magnetic fields. So that's the basic situation of the ionosphere. It's created primarily by sunlight, so it's strongest in the afternoon after it's had all day to build up under the sun. It's weakest just before dawn. But things can move around a lot and be transported from place to place. But that's the basics of the ionosphere. It's a balance between the production by sunlight and the loss by the particles meeting up and turning back into normal gas molecules.
And when I hear about the atmosphere, I'm picturing weather or things related to climate change. Why is the Defense Department specifically interested in learning about the ionosphere?
Well, this is James Battis. Basically, as Todd mentioned, the ionosphere is electrically charged. So if you pass radio waves through the ionosphere, the waves are affected by the ionosphere. And this can affect things like the quality of the signal, say from a satellite to the ground, or shortwave communications from the ground to ground. If we were to have any space-based surveillance equipment, of course, electromagnetic waves passing through the ionosphere can be disturbed by activity in the ionosphere. And, people are probably very familiar with the GPS system. When the signals from the GPS come down through the ionosphere, their paths are actually deflected by the structure of the ionosphere. And some of the error that they get, of course, GPS isn't completely accurate, but some of that error is because of these distortions created by the ionosphere. Now, for us...
Naturally occurring distortions.
Naturally occurring distortions, yes. For us driving on the highway, the GPS says to take the next left. The errors aren't really that significant. There's only one left up ahead. But if you're the military and you require high-quality location information and everything, then the behavior of the ionosphere and its characteristics are critical for your application. And that's one of the reasons that DOD is interested.
Now, this is Craig again. I want to make one comment. You mentioned the atmosphere. The ionosphere portion of the atmosphere begins at more around 60 miles of altitude and goes out to tens of thousands of kilometers. So it's well above any kind of tropospheric weather that would take place.
That's right. Spacecraft fly through it like it's not even there.
Right.
Except for charging effects. If you think about where the space shuttle's flying, it's right in the heart of the ionosphere.
Now, Mr. Battis and Dr. Pedersen are from the Air Force Research Laboratory's Space Vehicles Directorate, and Dr. Selker and Bernhardt are at the Naval Research Laboratory's Plasma Physics Division. Now, I was wondering if somebody from each side, first Air Force and then Navy, could really hone in on what specific expertise you bring and then why your service is specifically interested in this research.
Well, again, this is James Battis. A lot of the Air Force interest, of course, is in terms of communications. Signals that are affected by the ionosphere are what they call high-frequency radio transmissions. And these are the transmissions which are used to communicate with aircraft and, and to satellites. And so the Air Force is interested largely in the communications aspect and the effects of the ionosphere on communications.
And from the Navy side?
Yeah, this is Craig. The Navy also is very interested in communications. We have ships all over the globe that we want to be in contact with at all times. So any effect the ionosphere has on communications is something that we want to study and learn as well as we can. Additionally, the HAARP technology, the HAARP system, can be used to create something that we call a virtual antenna by heating a given area and then modulating the frequency that you heat with. You can generate extremely low frequency and even VLF waves, and then these actually penetrate the oceans to a greater depth than higher frequency waves would, and allows us to communicate with submarines when they're at speed and in depth. And so the Navy's interested in that technology in order to develop a effective system for communicating with submarines.
Now, HAARP conducts both basic and applied research, and my understanding is that there are also academic institutions who are investigating the ionosphere as well. How can the knowledge of the ionosphere translate into something tangible for the general public? You've already mentioned GPS. Is there anything else?
Well, I think not just the military use the HF communications, but also the aircraft flying, particularly over the poles, use HF communications for communications. And the particularly in the Arctic region, when you have solar events which create strong conditions, I'll say, in the polar area, those communications can get blacked out. So anything that could improve the ability of communications for DOD also has applications in the civil aviation community. And that's also true for just ground-to-ground communications.
This is Craig. The biggest impact for any kind of commercial, civilian user would be, again, in the communication aspect. And, we have the GPS, as Jim mentioned, but there's also even, like, satellite radio and satellite television can get impacted by naturally occurring ionospheric situations and conditions. And trying to understand those allows us to initially begin to predict and maybe to ameliorate the problem.
Now, the full title of HAARP is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. And that has a lot going on there. Can you guys break down the different components? What is high frequency, what is active, and what is auroral? And then tell us what they mean and how they relate to the work.
This is Jim Battis again. The high frequency refers to our radio transmitter, the frequency band that it can operate in. It's essentially from 3 to 10 megahertz. The active term really is a discussion of the way that we conduct our research. Historically, when people studied the ionosphere, they have a radio, they transmit a signal, they see what the effect is somewhere else, and it was pretty much a climatological study. In other words, they didn't have a lot of methods to affect the ionosphere, so they were just seeing what happened and try to understand what happens, but you couldn't really do anything. In the active research, in this case, we're actually able to transmit radio waves, and as Craig had stated earlier, and I think Todd did also, these radio waves that we transmit from the array at our facility actually create processes and interactions with the particles in the ionosphere, and in some small area of the ionosphere might trigger new processes or different responses, which we can use. Hopefully we can learn what the responses are that are occurring and how to use them to improve communications or any type of transmissions through the ionosphere. So that's what the active part means. I think a little bit the auroral is a little bit of a misnomer. I think it's a reference to our altitude. And although we are related in some ways to aurora, I think Todd will probably get into that a little more later on, really it's our location in the high latitudes that I believe the aurora...
Yeah, we're in the auroral zone, so it's... Really...
Yeah, it's... If we're the auroral zone, which is where the aurora are occurring naturally, actually changes with time, depending on the level of solar activity. And it can move south and recede to the north. And we're, the location in Gokona, Alaska, is actually outside of the sort of average, normal auroral zone. It's what, in conditions, we call mid-latitude. But at times, as activity increases, the auroral oval goes further south, so we're also able to see the what's called the polar cap conditions, which are those, the ionosphere inside the auroral oval. And so actually the location of HARP is an excellent location, because we do see, you know, if we were a lot further north, we would only see the polar conditions. If we were a lot further south, we would only see the mid-latitude. So we get to see both mid-latitude and polar ionosphere.
Now, if I produced an effect in the ionosphere, I got to admit I probably wouldn't know that I did it. But when HARP produces an effect in the ionosphere, you guys are able to detect and observe the phenomenon. How are you able to do this?
Well, there are a couple categories of sensors. We have radio wave sensors, which send waves up to the ionosphere, listen for a reflection or an echo off something up there. And we also have passive sensors that will listen to waves produced in the ionosphere. That's one of Craig's specialties. And then also optical sensors.
Which is one of Todd's.
Yes, that's my specialty. So basically, we're putting energy into the ionosphere, and some of it eventually comes back out, and we're picking up on that energy, whether it's in the form of radio waves coming back to a radar or radio sensor, whether it's in the form of structure that's been produced that now provides echoes back to an active radio system, or whether it's in the form of optical emissions. When these electrons get moved around by the electric field, they ultimately run into molecules up there, and when they have enough energy, they'll excite them, and it'll give off light, just like inside a fluorescent light bulb. So those are the primary ways of determining whether something has happened or not.
Now, are the effects observed as a result of these radio transmissions actually echoing natural processes which are observed normally?
Most of them are closely related to, if not identical to, natural processes. For example, if you have an aurora, you've got large electric fields putting a lot of energy into it. You have a lot of electrons shooting around. Those will hit into molecules and give off light, which is the aurora that we see. They will create irregularities. They will create instabilities. So, yes, the processes are all natural processes, but we have a degree of control over them, and we have a way of measuring what input went into it, as opposed to you get a big aurora overhead, you get lots of light, you get lots of everything, but it's very, very hard to know exactly what went into that, and it's also very dynamic. It changes from second to second, minute to minute.
Yeah, that actually refers again to the active portion of the program, the reason for that in there. And that allows us to, instead of just making observations, we can control the amount of energy that we're inserting into the ionosphere and make measurements on very specific times and frequencies so that we can understand and pull out these very subtle differences that are going on. And without the active control, you wouldn't be able to do anything like that.
So you can actually distinguish between a natural event from one that's man-made?
And for most of the things, yes.
Right.
The man-made ones go away when we turn the transmitter
right.
off. That's the best way of making sure, is if HARP is going on and off, and
right.
your effect goes on and off, then you know for sure it was HARP.
It also allows us to repeat an experiment in a given time frame, as opposed to waiting for the conditions to be exactly right once again. You can actually repeat the experiment again and again and again and verify that you're getting the data, and the data means what you think it does.
Right.
And that's
again,
kind of key to the scientific method, being able to do something like that.
Right, and we know the inputs, and we can control the inputs. We can say,
exactly.
Well, what happens if we have half as much power going into it? We can dial it down and do the experiment at half power. What if we do it in a different direction relative to the magnetic field? Whereas with just natural processes, it's hard to have them occur at the right time in the right place for you to make all these measurements. Whereas with HARP, we know that if something happens, it's going to be where all our instruments are pointed, and we have some control over the inputs, the energy inputs to the processes.
Now, all this is possible because of the HARP Research Facility, of course. What makes that facility unique?
Well, this is James Battis again. As I said earlier, one of the key uniquenesses of it is its location, and which is right on the edge of the auroral zone, so that we see both polar cap conditions and subauroral conditions at our facility. The power of the transmitters is unique in that we are 3.6 megawatts of power, which makes us the largest radio transmitter on the Earth today. It's what's called a phased array, which means that we have a series of antennas distributed over about 35 or 40 acres of ground, 180 antennas, and we can actually direct the signal within about 15 degrees of the zenith and move the signal in time, so we can paint the sky or within those 15 degree cones, we can direct it towards magnetic zenith or directly overhead. And these are all things which, and also the fact that we have a bandwidth basically of about 2.3 to 10 megahertz, all the similar facilities are typically more restricted to single or maybe three or four frequencies in that band, whereas we were able to do more continuous frequencies. And none of the other facilities, to my knowledge, really have the ability to sweep the signal or direct it. It's basically, they basically send their signals vertical into the ionosphere.
Well, some of the other facilities do have a means to re-steer the beam, but they can't do it in anything approaching, this is Craig, by the way, anything approaching the time frame that HARP is able to do it. They're able to do it in about 15 milliseconds, milliseconds, go from one pointing angle, we call it, to another pointing angle, change frequency within 10 to 20 seconds, almost anywhere within that frequency range that Jim referred to. And that allows you to really expand the kind of experiments that you can do. You can, as Jim mentioned, you can start sweeping the beam around in space, and you can change frequencies to try and find if there's a frequency that has a stronger interaction with the ionosphere. Many of the researchers make use of those features. I know Todd does.
And, of course, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, HARP is wonderful.
Well, we have a story of that was posted on our blog that Dr. Pedersen wrote, and there's some pictures of the antenna array on there, as well as a really interesting story of his journey in negative 37-degree weather out to the facility. When you look at the array, it either appears that it's extremely new and futuristic, or that it's extremely old, or it's from some sort of post-apocalyptic science fiction film. How long has this been? How long has the tool been there?
This is Jim Battis. The actual construction of the facility started in 1993, and we were performing experiments starting in about 1996 at 9.6 megawatts, about a quarter. Roughly a quarter of the present array. Point nine six megawatts. About a quarter of the present size. Between 2003 and 2006, we actually increased the facility, built out the facility to its present size, which was the original plan, the original design of the facility, but we were it took a while to get to that point. Now, one thing I would like to point out, you were saying how futuristic it looks, and I'll agree with you on that. Actually, the technology at the facility in terms of the transmitters and everything is pretty much 1990s technology. The original prototype array that we built, this 0.96 megawatt array, essentially the same technology that was used in completing the facility.
Yeah, some of the difficulties that we had in the, not difficulties, but some of the challenges that were in expanding the facility were actually more associated with being able to control the entire array, because timing is very important. So when you're giving your commands to each one of those individual transmitters, you can't have one transmitter be off by even a microsecond from another transmitter, or else you run into trouble. So we had to have a very high bandwidth fiber optic network that would allow us to send the information out to the entire array, and challenges along those lines were as opposed to any of the technology associated with the actual transmitters themselves.
Is this something that's really energy intensive to run as well?
Yes. To transmit the 3.6 megawatts, you have to generate roughly 10 megawatts of power. It's just the inefficiencies, the losses between the generator facility and the along the cables and everything out to the transmitters. So it does require quite a bit of energy.
And what are some of the recent results that you have observed at the HARP facility?
Well, I think Todd's had some of the most exciting results that we've had recently, if you want to talk about any of those.
Sure. The most exciting thing I've been involved in is that since about 2 years ago now, we found that at full power, HARP is able to give enough energy to the electrons that when they hit the gas molecules, they not only produce some light, but they're able to knock additional electrons off of the gas molecules and add to the plasma that's there. Earlier I mentioned that the sunlight does that, and that's how we get the ionosphere in the first place, but the aurora also does it. The electrons come shooting from the aurora from far out in space. They hit the gas molecules, they knock electrons off, and they create a temporary ionosphere for the duration of time the aurora is there, and we're now able to do on a very small scale the same sort of thing. We can add to the ionosphere enough that we can actually start doing the experiment in that little spot of plasma that we created from the transmitter, and that's been a very exciting thing, and I think kind of a fruition of some of the goals of the HARP project, and that this is now something that hasn't been done before and gives us a lot of opportunities to really study it. We're not stuck with just the plasma that nature gives us as a result of the sunshine, but we can actually make some and watch how it evolves and how it responds.
And what will the next steps be down that research track in the future?
Try and figure out exactly how that process is happening and how we can control it a little better. Right now we know what frequency to hit it with, and we can make it goes away after a few minutes. We aren't sure exactly how that's happening or whether we can make it last a little longer. We don't know if it's a smooth type of distribution or if it's just a bunch of spots. We have reasons to think both processes might be happening, so try and find out exactly what's happening in these artificial plasmas would be the next step.
Yeah, this field has been what we call data starved for many years, because there weren't enough facilities that were of the kind of power that HARP has and the location that HARP is, and so there was a lot more theorists that were able to come up with ideas for how the various interactions would take place, but you wouldn't have the actual data to support and figure out which one's right and which one's wrong, and so now we're reaching a situation where we're starting to kind of have a flood of data that's almost overwhelming the theorists, and they're desperately trying to catch up. So it's a nice position to be in as an experimentalist.
Yes, it is.
Just a couple questions before we end today's program. From time to time, we break out the old Armed with Science crystal ball. Could you guys identify just some of the major questions that you're going to be focusing on down the road in this area of research?
Well, I think this is Jim Battis. I think the area that Todd is working in is certainly for the next few years probably one of our prime areas of research. One area that we're interested in looking at and seeing if we can make a contribution to the understanding is the area of substorm generation. This, when I'll let Todd or Craig discuss that a little more, but substorms are those events which sometimes cause power outages on the ground and everything, and they can have negative effects on communications again. And
these are naturally occurring storms that take place in the Earth's magnetosphere that end up having impact in the Earth's ionosphere, which is a lower level. Magnetosphere is at the tens of thousands of kilometers altitude.
Right. So think of it as a burst of activity in the aurora. It's not any kind of weather down near the Earth. It's still way out in space.
But it has significant impact on satellite systems, just in terms of their viability. There was a big storm about a decade ago that knocked out power in Canada for a little while. And so understanding when these storms are taking place and how to predict them is of key importance right now.
I think we have a small effort along those lines in the HARP program to try to understand the processes that generate these substorms.
Right, the interactions between the ionosphere and the magnetosphere and how that plays a role.
Now, if possible, is there a representative story that any of you guys have that could demonstrate, you know, like what kind of training and background somebody would need to get to doing this kind of research? Does everyone kind of follow the same path, or are you all coming from different angles?
I think we come from slightly different angles. I know I actually started my undergraduate field in economics and then became a physicist and doing laboratory plasma physics. You know, plasma is the material that the Earth's ionosphere is made of. And I was doing laboratory work in graduate school for that, and very basic science research, but not studying the ionosphere. And I had a what they called a practicum that let me work with somebody here at the Naval Research Lab at a facility similar to a HARP. There's a facility in Russia called Sura. And so I kind of did a little 1 or 2 month program there working with him and doing some research there and kind of got the bug for doing ionospheric work instead and kind of transitioned to my field to that.
So economics to physics, does anybody else have a story?
I don't think anybody wants to grow up to be an ionospheric researcher because you never hear of it until about the time you get into graduate school.
Exactly.
And then starts coming up on your radar and you say, oh, this is pretty interesting. But it is an interesting field. I, too, had a tortuous path. My bachelor's degree is actually in Japanese, and I worked translating newspaper articles to put myself through grad school. But I always liked science from the time I was a kid, and I was pursuing a double major. And when I went to grad school, I studied physics and got involved in ionospheric research. And it's really quite enjoyable. And any kids out there, I recommend it. It's an interesting field.
This is Jim Battis. I guess I had the most normal path. I was solid Earth geophysics. In other words, I was looking at the solid Earth behaviors. And as Craig had mentioned earlier, one of the things that we can do with HARP is generate ELF-VLF radio waves that actually are able to penetrate through the water and actually into the Earth. And so you can use them to survey what's under the Earth. For example, you can do mineral exploration, and that's how I got into the program originally, was looking at using these ELF waves for looking at the structure of the Earth. So it's a little, again, I wasn't really in ionospheric physics, but once I got into the program, it was found it to be a fascinating area.
Well, you guys demonstrate, as always, that scientists also come in different shapes and sizes, which is great. As we finish today's program, I wanted to offer any of you the chance to give us any final thoughts or to any last-minute details that you have.
I guess I will say, along the same lines of what you were just asking, one of the most positive aspects of the HARP program that I've seen is, as Craig stated earlier, this area was a data-starved area of science for many years. And with the development of HARP, and we do make it available to a lot of university researchers, you know, both through Air Force contracts, and we actually have a summer school where we have graduate students come up independent of having a contract, particularly with the Air Force, and they can come up and do some research. What we've seen is that we've been able to attract a lot of young graduate students, even some undergraduate students, into the area of ionospheric physics. And one of the most positive aspects of HARP has been the fact that we have actually, at this point, seen students who came in as young first-year graduate students who have now progressed. They've gotten their PhDs working on HARP-related projects, and they're actually now out at various universities and companies continuing to do research in this area. So HARP has produced a lot of really good science and scientists over the last 15 years.
This is Todd Pedersen. I'd just like to say that one thing I find particularly interesting about doing research within the DoD is that there are reasons for what we do and there are benefits from the discoveries we make. We're not holed up in a corner lab somewhere studying something that may or may not have an application 100 years from now. There are very real problems, and we're addressing those, and there are very real benefits that can come from this type of research. So it's the enjoyment of science and also knowing that your research has a chance of making an impact to somebody out there.
Well said. Our guests today are all members of the HARP team, Mr. James Battis, HARP Program Manager at the Air Force Research Laboratory, Dr. Todd Pedersen, a Senior Research Physicist at the Air Force Research Laboratory, Dr. Craig Selker, HARP Program Manager at the Naval Research Laboratory, and Dr. Paul Bernhardt, a Senior Research Physicist at the Naval Research Laboratory. Gentlemen, I really do appreciate your time today and for helping us understand some of the really important work you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Listeners, please tune in next Wednesday, March 3rd, when we head back to the gaming world to explore Urban Sim, a turn-taking strategy game created by the USC Institute of Creative Technologies in collaboration with the U.S. Army's Simulation and Training Technology Center. This virtual training application provides an opportunity to practice the art of battle command in complex counterinsurgency and stability operations. Don't miss it. Thank you again for listening. I'm Dr. John Ohab, and you've been scienced.